Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
Wendy, I'm home.
Sally, when I promised to kill you last?
That's right, Major. You did.
I lied.
Right. Welcome to episode one.
Hey!
Of Movies to Drink To, despite the fact there's about 50 other episodes under a different name, but that's all archived now.
Ooh. Yeah. This is all new.
Yep. I am Finn.
I am Lee.
And I am Mr. Smith.
Yes, and this is, as we said, Movies to Drink To, where we like to take a look at films that are best watched with a drink in hand, whether it be to celebrate or just try and forget what you've just seen.
Or cope. Numb the pain.
Numb the pain, yeah. Some are raise a beer and go, yay! Some are bottle of rum to yourself kind of level.
Downing a bottle of Jägermeister.
Yeah. Ah, it's been a while.
And sobbing.
Yes.
Today we are talking about director Stephen Norrington. Who? I hear you say. Who?
Collectively.
And rightly so, some would say.
Yes. Well, don't worry, we're going to tell you all about him and the films he made. He only directed four films, and all of them are A Reason to Drink. For some reason or another. Now, let's go back to the beginning. Stephen Norrington was born sometime in 1964, we think in London. Actually quite hard to find out any information on this guy.
There's nothing on his past whatsoever.
There really isn't. He's a bit of a...
enigma.
Well, not really an enigma, just a nothing.
I think he's actually a British clone of Tommy Wiseau, and that's why it's all so mysterious.
Maybe. Where he was educated, don't know.
Cool. School.
Great. Yeah. England.
Hogwarts.
We all are. We all go to Hogwarts.
Well, yeah, obviously. I had a pet rat.
Yeah, took my carriage there just the other day.
He started his career in special effects and makeup and is also a sculptor.
Mm.
Yes, and he worked under the likes of Rick Baker and Stan Winston.
Mm.
And he worked on films such as Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
Young Sherlock Holmes. Anyone remember that?
I do.
That's great. Yeah.
I loved it when I was a kid. Yeah. And that bit where the cakes force themselves into that kid's mouth is terrifying.
Yes. That weird evil turkey thing in it as well.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah.
He also worked on Aliens.
Nice.
The Witches.
Mm-hmm.
Terrifying.
Did the Grand High Witch makeup and all that. Hardware, which is Stanley's first film.
Yes.
Alien 3. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And one of the Hellraiser films.
Bloodline. One of the Blade films.
One of the Blade films. He definitely worked on one of the Blade films. Yeah, yeah. In 1994, he made his first film as director, Death Machine.
Death Machine.
Even the title promises great things.
Yes, it's metal as fuck.
Right.
1994. He wrote and directed this.
Mm.
And it stars Brad Dourif.
Hey.
And some other people.
Elie Puget, pretty sure I'm saying it right. William Hootkins, John Sherrion.
Actually know him.
Martin McDougall, Andreas Wojciechowski, a very young Richard Brake, and Rachel Weisz.
Oh, yeah.
In one scene.
Yeah, 30 seconds.
Yes, it was her first big screen appearance ever.
Mm.
The plot of this thing is...
Chank Armaments is experimenting with the ultimate fighting machine, which is part human, part machine. So far, the Hard Man Project, giggity, has been unreliable and has killed a number of innocent people. The genius behind this project is Jack, who lives in a world of models, toys, and magazines. When he is fired by Kale for killing a few corporate officers, he unleashes the ultimate killing machine called the War Beast against Kale and those who would help her.
So it's called the War Beast, not Death Machine.
Yeah, it's actually called the
War
Beast.
It's referred to as Death Machine, like once.
Yeah, and otherwise it's War Beast.
Yeah.
It even says on its control pad, War Beast.
Even the password to activate it is War Beast.
Yeah.
Not Death Machine.
No. Yeah.
So it's about Chanuk or Chank.
Chank.
Yeah, Chanck, an evil corporation, basically, and they're in a big building which looks like something out of Judge Dredd.
Mm.
Yeah.
And there's a thing they mentioned that some stuff has gone wrong with Chunk's equipment and children died.
Did we watch the director's cut, by the way?
The two-hour version, the big long.
The longest one there is. It's the longest version of this film. We watched it.
It shows that some children died by showing loads of burnt dolls. Which is odd.
Would you rather they actually showed the
burnt children?
Yes, that's fair.
Yes, we have, young Richard Brake as one of the... I think he's like the an executive.
Chunk.
Yeah.
And he's evil, obviously, because it's Richard Brake.
And his name is Scott Ridley.
Have
you noticed the character names?
They're brilliant.
Ridley, Raimi, Weyland and Yutani, John Carpenter and Dante.
Dante was based on Joe Dante.
The best is Scott Ridley.
Okay.
I did wonder if this was Stephen Norrington breaking into movies, trying to think like he's like allegorically killing off all the potential competition with his War Beast, and maybe it was his plan, if had he made it bigger, to build his own death machine and take out anybody else that would make up a better film. It would have been a very, very busy machine.
The cast would have been much bigger if he was trying to kill off everybody that made a better film than him.
Think Sean Connery. This is Connery, Sean. a young Richard Brake, who just is a bit jarring seeing him young.
Odd.
He's essentially an evil corporate guy. And we have Elie Puget's character, who I've just referred to as Power Woman. And she is also an executive there.
Hayden Cale, I think it's
him. That's it. Yeah,
I only know because I've got it in front of me. I think
that's the only name that doesn't refer to anyone.
I think so.
Yeah, basically.
I even Googled it to see if it
did. Yeah, I did.
Googled loads of stuff to double check it. They didn't come up as anything other than this.
And we're introduced to Brad Dourif's character, who's all grungy. And he's just a fucking prick. He's one of these people that thinks he's better than everybody.
Yeah, and he lives in like a back of the warehouse surrounded by He-Man and Thundercats toys.
Yeah, he lives in their stock room or something.
Yeah.
It's odd.
Yeah, it is odd.
But he is the...
I liked his toy collection, though.
Yeah, he's the guy who's built the death machine.
Their main thing is the Hard Man project, though, at the moment, which is like the ultimate policeman.
Yeah.
Like a shit cardboard Robocop.
Yes.
But shouts a lot. So much.
Meanwhile, we've got a guy with red face paint who is part of some team of stoners. Team of people made up of Stephen Norrington's, I think.
Yeah, so that's Yutani, the one with the
Weyland
red face.
Weyland and Yutani. Yeah.
And Sam Raimi.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, Sam Raimi's our sort of like main almost hero guy, and then the other one, Weyland, is actually he's the younger blonde brother from Die Hard. When he gets dragged down the stairs at the beginning.
Oh, ho, now have a machine gun.
Yes, please.
Yeah, how about that?
It did take me a good hour of this movie to figure out what the fuck these people were doing.
It does. Yeah, the plot takes a while to get going. It really does. They have like they have a boardroom meeting. They establish that Brake is evil because he pushes a man for no reason as he walks out of the elevator.
He says fuck all the time, so he must be bad.
There's a computer voiceover at some point as well, which I think is explaining the plot of the film, but you couldn't really understand what it was saying.
One review
I listened to of that described it as, it sounds like Siri is drunk.
It really does. Yeah, it's horrible.
And then Brad Dourif's Jack Dante breaks into Power Woman's house and does some overacting. And it turns out Power Woman did porn at some point in her life.
This is the first coat gag that they do, where Dante's coat has many pockets, apparently, and they keep pulling out guns, and he pulls out a rubber chicken. Apparently Norrington thought was so good they did it twice.
They did a rubber chicken joke.
Yep.
The same joke.
Yeah. It's just the second time is much longer with many more guns before they get to the rubber chicken.
Yes. So that's happened. And now our gang of stoners are going to break into Shank's headquarters to steal some stuff and do some badness and steal a, quote, quad matrix googoplectic co-processors.
Yeah, they're eco-terrorists, apparently.
Yes, those... That Those are words.
They are.
That Norrington wrote down.
Now, remember when we talked together about Blade and you said they talk a load of techno bollocks?
Yeah.
I give you.
You do get the impression that Norrington's style of writing for when it comes to these particular plot devices is to put words into a hat and then pull them out.
Quad matrix, googolplectic coprocessor. Here, say this line. But why?
You can write this shit, George, but you sure can't say it.
Then grungy Brad Dourif shows up and starts having an argument with Richard Brake where they spit a lot.
He's like talking like Daffy Duck.
He does. What? But then Brake does it back to him as well.
But how else are we supposed to know that they're crazy?
And they spit. It's weird.
Yeah.
And then Brad unleashes his T-Rex robot.
Oh, God, that's terrible.
What it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Also, he seems to think that Power Woman is his girlfriend, Richard Brake.
For some reason,
Brad Dourif thinks that Power Woman is his girlfriend.
Yes.
I don't know where he got that idea from. Richard
Brake, don't talk about my girlfriend like that.
That's it. Mm. And then unleashes the T-Rex robot to kill Brake.
Yeah, and it's the first time the robot's released, it's just an assault on the senses, because it plays like a video game. You don't really see much of the robot itself.
Yeah.
But it's like this loud, flashing noise, like seizure-inducing fucking the scene where it's just like a bad like arcade game.
So apparently the idea behind that was obviously he's named the character Sam Raimi. It's meant to be his version of like a digital equivalent of like the evil chasing things in Evil Dead, that kind of like
it's not even close.
It does that camera work though, doesn't it?
Camera work he was
just
going.
Do that then. Just
The point of view of the T-Rex robot and the rest of the film kind of does play out like a shit version of Aliens. The first one more than the second.
In fact, it actually says game over when it catches him as well. You're like, I get
it. They quote from loads of different films. Terminator.
Yeah, they quote from Terminator. There's this fucking Street Fighter 2 quote in there.
Yeah, there is. Right. There's about halfway through this film, it suddenly changes. It stops taking itself at all seriously and suddenly decides it's a bit of a comedy.
Yep.
So the plot kind of actually happens now. And what we've got is the group of stoners who have broken in and a small group of executives that are now locked in the building, a la Judge Dredd. And Brad Dourif is essentially holding them all hostage with his giant robot dinosaur until he gets what he wants. His job back and also Power Woman to sleep with him.
Yes.
Right.
But why else would you build a robot?
Yeah.
Can't think of the amount of women I've seduced with my bad Meccano sets.
Under threat of death from my robot is how most of my relationships start and end.
I was hoping we could have a nice intimate connection.
So they make their way through the building trying to escape. It's revealed that the stoners, although armed to the teeth, actually have blanks.
Yeah,
they have
no bullets, no real bullets.
But they do have real explosives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Is that when one of them, like, it goes, it made me laugh for about 20 minutes. He goes, oh, is anybody going to blow something up? He goes, has anyone got a match? He goes, not me. He goes, me either, but I do have a thermic detonator. He just thrusts everything into shot really aggressively.
It's like he's moving like an anime character, almost. Like Yutani had me in stitches for the entire film. I was like, can I just watch a movie just about this guy? Like, he's hilarious.
The elevator scene's quite cool.
Yeah, actually, that was the actual one kind of like good scene.
Yeah, they're all in the lift and the robot thing is coming up through the floor and a couple of them get eaten. Is it John Carpenter gets killed?
Yeah, he gets ripped in half down the elevator shaft and Yutani gets his leg stabbed, which he shakes off almost immediately after performing the world's best sutra with his own underwear.
Yeah, that's odd as well. Just take it off.
Fucking hysterical. he's got to yank it out like a ninja.
Just wedgies himself. Atomic wedgies himself.
That's it, yeah. He rips it out and he's wearing these ridiculously comic book cartoon pants as well.
Really odd.
Also, it's weird that this film, it does say that it's set in the near future. Apparently set in 2003. But everyone still uses floppy disks and fax machines.
And really large televisions.
Yes, yes. So then they find out what's the program? The War Beast thing, where they're turning veterans into robot people that fight for them and are police and do their bidding.
Clearly, Stephen Norrington has seen Universal Soldier a few too many times.
And Terminator. But
I mean, it is literally the plot to Universal Soldier.
And then they decide to put one of the stoners into the machine. mm-hmm. and make him...
Sam Raimi.
Sam Raimi.
He becomes the hero.
Yeah, he's put into the machine to become a robot man, half robot fighting machine, and he shouts a lot.
That's how you know
as soon as he becomes the robot, all he does is shout all of his lines.
Follow me, and don't argue!
Brilliant, I love that.
This area is secure!
Turns around, and the thing stood 3 fucking feet from it.
It's like, you are rubbish!
That's pretty much the film. They fight.
Oh, they get a...
Oh, at the end, there's a...
They get a fax for some reason at one point, and a bloke throws it, thrusts it at someone, tells him to go fax himself. Fax yourself.
And you get the greatest fake laugh in history afterwards, with just a...
How clever do you feel?
And yeah, in the finale, when the Stoner Robot Man is fighting, there's like a scene where he just punches him for ages and ages and ages. And then later on, the other one shoots at it for ages and ages and ages.
There is when they find those two like futuristic looking guns, and I think they're firing at them for a full 3 hours.
Yeah, like, it just goes on and on.
They don't reload, they don't run out of ammunition. Like, it just fucking hell. And
we do get a bit of useless plot information about Kale, that she somehow put her baby in a garbage disposal.
Yeah.
I must have missed that. Was that after or before she did
it's
porn?
Something that Dante brings up. And apparently she was bathing her kid in the sink or something, and then it went in the garbage.
I only looked away for a moment.
It's so weird.
So she put her arm down the garbage disposal unit.
It keeps flashing to this like red-coloured like drain.
It really looks like someone's throwing a teddy bear into a massive vagina.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
And that's when Dante starts doing that weird stuff where he goes, I'll be your baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brad Dourif's character is a bit of a Milhouse.
He's very
sad and weird.
He's fucking nuts.
And yeah, basically, and then they escape and the good guys win and yada yada yada.
But the Yutani's doing that the hero bit where he's firing at the thing. Have you noticed that when he turns to... There's nothing really dramatic that happens for his like sacrificial bit, apart from he turns around and bashes his head on the fucking door frame
and falls down and dies. Oh, that was hilarious. And you get a full-on proper dong. It's a real cartoon sound effect when he does it. The only bit that made me chuckle more than that was when they get out, because they managed to escape in the lift that's travelling like 300 miles an hour towards the ground. I'm pretty sure it's surpassed terminal velocity at this point.
Yeah.
They're fine when they hit the bottom and they see a copper there. And they're like, no, don't shoot.
That copper's fucking terrible. Like,
sucks to be you! And then the thing just falls off the fucking building and lands on his head.
This is the one copper that exists in this world as well. Because when they phone the police at one point, and this copper's sitting there spinning his gun around and dropping it and stuff. Mm. And he's like, yeah? And they're like, oh, we've got an emergency. He's like, oh, yeah, okay. They're like, no, really, people are dying. Yeah, buddy.
It's like the one cop on shift is just like the most snarky, arrogant twat going.
As he looks up, he's like, is Holy Donuts.
Holy Donuts.
Holy Donuts, just before it hits him in the face.
Is the cop the guy from fucking Silent Night, Deadly Night 2?
That's what
I'm saying. You've got an emergency, have you? People are dying.
Robot day.
Death machine. Yeah, and he dies and blah, blah, blah. Overall, it's pretty childish.
Yeah.
Is how I describe this film.
It is, what's the word I'm looking for? Shoddy.
Yeah. Visually, it's not. Visually, it looks a lot like Hardware, which obviously we mentioned that he worked on. Although I'd say Hardware is the far superior film.
Mm.
But there are some, like, just even in some shots, you're like, why have you set it up like that?
Yeah.
Why am I looking at the back of this guy's head when he's not talking to anybody? It's just stuff like that.
In the first big death with the death machine, War Beast, whatever, what's his name, Richard Brake, rather than show any kind of like attack or blood, he settles for CGI paper falling to the ground.
Something like that. And then it gets written off as, they said, what was the cause of death? They go, oh, it was a shark attack. Did you catch that? The fucking shark attack, 30 stories up in an office building. Yeah,
office brilliant. Shark. There's a film.
And again, it just reeks of... Lads, I've got an idea.
It's such a tonal mess. Like I say, like, it starts off like it's almost taking itself seriously, and about halfway through the film, they must have gone, this is not a serious film. Can't get away with that.
I think they took our approach, and obviously they must have just wanted to drink while they were making it. And just like, oh, for fuck it, just go for it. Just your head on the thing, it'll be funny.
Right, I've got an idea.
Yeah, critics didn't love this. It did get some pretty good reviews for its effects.
Mm.
Right.
But acting and plot, no. But it was made for $500,000.
It's got a big cult
which
following.
It is impressive.
Well. It has got a big cult following.
Has it?
Yeah.
Because I put a thing up on Instagram and 80% of people have never heard of this.
Yeah, I saw, which surprised me because, I watched three
I'd
or
never
four
heard
music.
Of this
no, I'd never
everyone
heard of this.
Is singing of it. It's like an underappreciated gem. And I was like, I mean, fuck off, no, but.
I do think that if you're saying it's got a cult following, I think if you put it in a cinema, the entire cult following could probably get in there.
Yeah. But, no, I would probably watch it again with a couple of beers, though, just to show it to someone.
If I could find a better copy than that one on YouTube, I'd probably give it another go. Not purely just to see what it really looks like.
There are four different versions of this film.
Why?
Because Norrington... Apparently, Norrington was just never satisfied with the final edit.
No.
Neither were we.
Yep. the one that we watched is the longest one of the four.
That is his chosen director's cut, is it?
I think it's just everything he filmed thrown into it.
Yeah, basically.
Chuck it in the fuck it bucket, chuck it out to the crowd.
I was amazed that he managed to get Blade off the back of this.
He did get Blade off the back of this, which brings us on nicely.
Mm.
The producers of Blade saw this and said... That's the guy I want. After watching it, it does kind of make you realise and appreciate how much of a gamble Blade was.
Yeah, even more so.
That's the guy. But yes.
And clearly he learnt a fucking lot in between movies.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, Blade is...
Well, he didn't write Blade, for a start. And
he had the backing of a studio for Blade, so he had a bit more money.
Yeah, it's like Death Machine. It was an English-Japanese collaboration, wasn't it? American-Japanese, but... Either way, there was a lot of Japanese involvement on it, which the moment I heard that, I think I was Googling it about halfway through the film, I read that, I was like, so much more of this makes so much more sense now, because it is kind of like watching like a be done live-action anime in places.
Yeah.
But yes, he then got Blade. We've talked about Blade on a couple of episodes in the past, and they are archived, and you can still listen to them. So we're not going to go through all of Blade again, but yes, Blade was very successful. It was the first successful Marvel movie ever.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, there was a time when no one looked forward to Marvel movies.
No, they'd had 30-odd
years ago,
and each of them had failed.
Yeah, when you had
horrendous.
The, you know, made-for-TV Captain America.
Roger Corman's Fantastic Four.
The Nick Fury.
She's legendary.
Howard the Bastard Duck.
Duck fucker.
Yeah, Marvel was...
poo-pooing cinema.
Yeah,
and they were a bit of a fucking joke. Now, say what you will about the MCU, it's bloody successful and worth a lot of money.
I love it.
You've never mentioned.
Just because I say what you will doesn't mean you don't have to start saying what you want.
You make me look like a casual fan when it comes to the Marvel movies.
Yeah.
And I fucking love them.
Yes, Blade had a budget of $45 million and made $131 million. And...
Blade had a budget of
45,
and it made 31.
131.
Oh right, okay.
No, that would not be a successful film.
What?
And obviously, it spawned the sequels, and then we got X-Men, and then we got Spider-Man, and the rest is nerd history.
Yes.
Yes.
Such so, history. Well, the rest is tattooed on my body.
Wearing a t-shirt.
I don't think I am today. No,
decorates my house.
Yes. Mr. Smith lives in a 12-year-old's bedroom.
12-year-old is terrified.
The 12-year-old doesn't mind.
So you kicked the 12-year-old out.
He's dead.
Like, this is mine now. I moved in.
You set fire to all his dolls and sold them to Stephen Norrington.
I positioned him and the family around to make it look like I have my own family. That went weird.
Yeah.
Yes, it was extremely successful, and it doesn't. I mean, Blade is still regarded as a great film and it has a lot of fans, but I don't think it gets the credit it deserves. Norrington doesn't get the credit he deserves for this film. He isn't really, well, he's not really spoken about at all, but when you think of like people that helped the MCU be, you know, Sam Raimi, John Favreau, what's that creep called, Joss Whedon, Norrington's name is never mentioned.
No, not at all.
And I don't just mean the MCU, I don't mean like ever. But like, he's...
Blade franchise in itself was a cash cow. Like, after the first one, the second one was a big hit.
Yeah.
Until they ruined it themselves with the third one. But, I mean, yeah, he should be recognised for helping the comic book adaptation, like, boom, really.
Yeah, definitely. And he's not at all.
No.
Even if you watch the honest trailer for the Blade trilogy, he's referred to as an unknown. and that's made by people that No, yeah, cinema, supposedly. Yeah. No cinema. Screen Rant.
Screen Rant winds me up, but...
Yeah, fuck him. At least we know who Stephen Norrington is.
Yeah.
Bunch of hacks. So, yes, anyway, Blade was hugely successful.
Oh, that must have hurt even more then, because I remember us saying, like, Wesley Snipes trying to get a Black Panther movie off the ground for ages, and when Black Panther came out, I was like, it's the first big black hero superhero movie.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
Wesley Snipes being the first superhero movie
with a black lead, and then it was all like Black Panther! Black, it's like,
No, go back a few years.
They did exist.
And he R-rated it, Deadpool.
Yeah.
First R-rated Black Blade comic book film.
And it's still fucking great.
Yeah. Right. He was then offered the chance to direct Blade 2.
Mm. Which he turned down.
Which he turned down in order to make this next film we're going to talk about. Now, I'm pretty sure there's quite a few people listening that have not heard of the Death Machine.
Mm.
I'll give you a fiver if you've honestly ever heard or seen this film.
Oh, I've never heard of it until we
Read an article about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which says the director's last film was Blade. Like, not true. There's a film in between.
There is a film in between. This one. It's called The Last Minute. And he made this instead of Blade 2.
Yeah.
God damn. The Last Minute was, I think, his passion project from 2001.
Apparently so.
He wrote it, he directed it, he edited it, produced it, and even did some of the music. It stars Max Beasley.
Using some weird Danny Dyer Cockney accent.
Yes. Jason Isaacs. Kate Ashford from Shaun of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Udo Kier from Blade.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Dorff cameo.
Stephen Dorff from Blinkin' You'll Miss Him cameo, yep.
Is he Brad Maddock or something?
Stephen Graham!
Yeah.
As another Cockney.
Yeah, he's a DJ.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's only in it for a minute.
He's in it for a couple of headbutts. Yeah.
And in the role of a lifetime, Stephen Norrington as drugged up guy on couch.
Yes.
The plot of this.
Which couch? There were a lot of drugged up people on couches.
Which one is he? He's not the one that jumps around trying to be Jay Muse, is he?
What, the one with the dreadlocks?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But they all look the same. There's like four of them.
Again, the show I watched on that one that you found, it wasn't great in places. Like, I couldn't.
Mm. I mean, again, I'm pretty sure that apartment they filmed it in, I think I've been in that place in three or four different cities with the same people in it.
Dark parts of our lives.
Didn't know I was going to be on camera again.
Also, full disclosure, illegally downloaded this because I'm pretty sure you can't buy this.
No, I looked everywhere. You can't buy it anywhere.
It's not on any streaming services.
Nope.
It's a nothing of a film.
Yes.
It's a ghost of a movie.
It's a fucking weird movie.
The plot of it is...
Billy Byrne is going to be the next big thing, the next pop idol, the next art scandal, the next screen dream. Doors and worlds of possibility open up. Then it all goes wrong. The world doesn't care about his style, his voice, his thing.
Yeah.
How long did it take you guys to figure out what the fuck it was he actually did?
He doesn't do anything.
He doesn't do anything. Well, he never discloses what it is.
He's just famous. I think the point of it is he's famous for being famous,
mm.
but then he even fucks that up.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing's supposed to be like a commentary on the industry and the fleetingness of fame.
But what industry?
Entertainment industry, I guess.
Yeah, we have this Billy Byrne guy who is yet famous, but for reasons that are not apparent and never actually disclosed throughout the 2 hours of this film.
It's Norrington's life story.
This film is, it is odd. It starts with, say, Billy going to there's an opening monologue which is a load of bollocks, but
it has nothing to do with anything.
Mm. No, it starts with him going to a talent agency in some big office, and there's that really odd shot of two dogs humping.
Stop motion CGI animatronic dogs humping.
It's very odd.
It's really it drags you right out of the film to the point where I rewound it. Because I was like, is that... Because like we've just said, I couldn't figure, is it CGI, is it stop motion, is it what?
Mm.
And even the second time I was like, I don't know what it is, but I'm disturbed.
It looked like stop motion to me.
Yeah.
It was, fucking odd. So anyway, he is, like we said, he's famous. We don't know what for. He's just famous and everybody loves him. It then goes through this kind of montage of him. He's in Japan, he's in Berlin, he's in London and all these fancy places, all this nonsense and weird... sort of flashy show-off editing going on.
He was stroking him and
yeah,
being near him.
He's then in a back in London in a nightclub, which is like the nightclub from Blade, but lit blue as opposed to red.
It feels like this film. It felt like a really pilled up Lock Stock to begin with.
Yeah, it has got that kind of Lock Stock Train Spotting vibe. Throughout the whole film,
manic sort of the shot construction and stuff. Mm. Yeah,
just the way it done, like the lots of sped up stuff and things happening quicker than they should and slowing down and all that dancing.
Yeah. He then goes backstage at the club where there's like a bod
like
mod
a VIP
area.
Club,
kind of like in Blade 2 where they've got the bod mod in the club as well. And we meet Jason Isaacs' character, who is basically he's a gangster, a drug baron of some sort.
He claims to be a crooner.
Yes, he also sings.
Twice.
Yeah.
Length.
Yes, it is odd where he goes over, beats up Stephen Graham.
Yeah, headbutts him, drags him across the podium and headbutts him.
And then proceeds to then start singing Frank Sinatra.
Mm. I've got you under my skin, isn't it?
I have to say, for my sins, I quite enjoyed this bit.
I actually enjoy every scene Jason Isaacs is in in this film.
He's hammy as everyone in this film hams it up. Mm. Like, nobody's trying to act well.
No.
Everyone's hamming it like as much as possible. But yeah, Jason Isaacs, when he does this whole singing thing and he's punching people and he puts a microphone, I assume, in some woman's vagina and says, hold that for a second, and then takes it out with the popping sound later on.
Unsanitary.
It is. Yeah, that, again, like the humping dogs, it just completely takes you out of whatever kind of crap film you're in.
Yeah. It's the whole song.
Yeah, it's the whole song. It's the whole song. Number. Mm. And then he walks into a room and sees a dude fisting another dude.
He's practically up to the elbow, isn't he?
And we see it. It's not like suggested. You see it on screen.
Yeah.
He's got his whole arm up a dude's arm.
And he sees Beasley walk in and he goes, oh, it's slow. What's his name? He goes, do what you're doing, man. I mean, it's really cool. Like,
yeah.
And then you see him outside.
He shake his hand to the girlfriend. He's like, well, actually.
Anyway, now, after that kind of is established, he's famous. He's now not famous. Mm. For some reason, he's just not popular, and
no context. He's just not popular anymore.
Nope. And he meets a homeless woman, and he goes through a tough time. A shopkeeper robs him, which is hilarious.
With a meat cleaver, that is fucking brilliant. Favorite bit is, you can fuck off now. Oh, don't forget your stuff.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing, isn't it? Because he's literally just buying some stuff, rather than sell it to him, the geezer robs him. The shopkeeper robs him.
And then
just before that, he's looking at a porn mag, and that bloke just staring at him, and he walks up, and he goes,
"Look at me when you shoot your beans, think of me."
Yeah. And then he meets a pig guy on the subway.
Yeah.
Who has nothing else to do. I think you see him later on in the film, but he's just nothing to do.
There's the cancer guy, and then the other guy who comes up to him for change, who calls him a fucking prick or whatever.
Yeah, that bollocks him for having no change. Yeah. No, because he only gives him like 50p or something.
Yeah. He spots him later on when he's in an underground bathroom somewhere. That guy's just glaring at him over the cubicles, and then there's two fat bald
guys. Oh, is that the same guy?
Yeah, he's running like a gay cubicle loan out thing, like these two big fat skinheads go in and start bumming each other.
His girlfriend leaves him.
Good.
Yeah.
He is then kicked out of the club that he was in before, because now he's not famous and he's too drunk.
He's sleeping in the stock room with his ass hanging out, covered in
shit.
No,
he's in a toilet. He's in a cubicle with vomit all down himself. Like, he's
lying
next to the
shit in there,
yeah, well, the toilet has a broom cupboard or something.
So he's then kicked out of the club, and once he's kicked out of the club, he is then mugged.
Yeah.
The muggers feel so sorry for him that they give him some money for a cab.
That actually really made
taxi
me laugh.
He then gets in the cab, and the cab scene is funny.
Yeah, cab scene.
Where he gets in the
dog from. Lockstock? No, is it Lockstock?
Yeah.
Snatch?
I can't remember. He's in one of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, you have a cab driver who won't shut up, and it turns out he's really racist and just likes to beat people up.
Yeah, mate, some of the slurs he's coming out with, I was like, bloody hell, mate.
To the point,
difficult watch.
I grew up in Portsmouth,
quite funny. Like, it just goes on about how he's beating all these people up.
Yeah.
He's a proper sociopath.
So I've got this cricket bat with all these nails I put through it, right?
Yeah. And then Billy Burnoff star pukes all over him.
Yeah.
And crashes the cab because he's got vomit all over the place.
That was fucking genius.
So he's having a bad time, and now he's homeless.
Yeah.
For reasons. So he's now homeless, and he meets the homeless woman again, and she takes him.
How old is she supposed to be?
I have no idea.
Because I question that all through the film.
I don't know. I assume like in her 20s.
She looks in her 20s, but obviously when you meet the rest of the gang.
Yeah.
Yeah, they go back to stay with... He goes back to stay with the homeless woman, who lives in a huge room, by the way, underground. Right. And this is where the film just turns into Oliver Twist set to drum and bass.
Yes. Yeah. It's
literally.
Complete with Fagin.
Yep. The little Artful Dodger. The woman is Artful Dodger.
Yeah.
He is Oliver. We have a Fagin. And there's all the other little pickpocketer kids.
But you can get lines like, what was it? He's reviewing the situation.
Yeah, all the kids are doing the whole Cockney accents as well.
Heavily implied that the Fagin is a nonce, and at one point gets called out for it as well. And he's got his little box of drug balloons that he's handing out to him always a treat.
Is this what they
And he's got his favourites.
They convince him to do drugs as well. Like, you should, let's just say, you should do drugs.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's really bizarre. Yes, it's
not. Like, no, I don't really do drugs. It's like, well, try some. Okay, and next thing you know, he's got more facial piercings and he's absolutely...
And he's got long hair as well, yeah.
That's what heroin does to
him. They did like a little bit of time jump, didn't they? But just before that, you've got the child rave.
Yeah.
Where they have a bit of a rave and they're all clearly doing drugs and they're all 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's also a subplot about some woman with a snake tattoo.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, which, she's like a voiceover thing, and then you've just... The only time you see the woman whose voice it is she's dead and they're stealing her bracelet.
Yeah, it's odd.
I think I missed that.
So,
yeah.
He's now Oliver Twist living with Fagin and the Artful Dodger. And Jason Isaacs shows up to get some money off of Fagin because he owes him. And they have a fight, and all Fagin and all the kids get murdered.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's literally Isaacs' gang shooting children.
Yeah.
And attacking children with a sledgehammer.
Again, not implied either. You're watching it all of it.
And then one of the kids has got a mutant rat or something in his bag that attacks Jason Isaacs.
Yep.
I figured it was the CGI greyhound thing from the beginning, just gone rabid.
I mean, maybe.
Who knows?
Once Jason Isaacs has killed everybody, he then breaks into When a Man Loves a Woman.
Well, he murders Nancy Fagin with the sledgehammer and goes, that's why they call me Percy, and then starts singing a Percy Sledge song.
Yeah.
Percy Sledge. Right. Why?
Again, a full on musical number.
Yeah, full song with these two
croons, like
bodyguards.
Covered in blood. Yeah, doing the doo-wop thing in the background. Makes no sense, but that moment's really entertaining. Jason Isaac nails it. So, after all that shit's gone down...
They run off with a box of drugs.
Yeah, our hero then goes back to the agency from the beginning, and he's got an idea.
Yeah.
Never explains what his idea... Again, it's actually almost impressive that they go for a two-hour film without ever explaining what this guy does. But he goes back with an idea, and all these scraps of paper with his idea.
And his old flatmate's in there who's been...
Who's now famous.
Yeah,
he's now the next big thing.
Him.
Yeah, for whatever reason. That doesn't work. They kick him out. He then finds a box of drugs, sells it, takes the money, flies to Iceland, the end.
Greenland.
Sorry.
He goes, I want to...
Yeah, there's a joke
Greenland.
About Iceland and Greenland getting confused.
Oh, Greenland's really nice. He says, I think you mean Iceland.
Yeah. And that's it. What the fuck?
It's exactly what I wrote at the end.
It just...
There's even an end credit scene that is fucking pointless. Like, I don't know if you watched it.
Yeah, I did. Yes,
yeah, it's just the girl, because there's a whole moment, is she going to go with him? He goes to get, there's a limo turns up goes to get in, and she then doesn't go with him.
She goes off
and then
the
you
famous...
get the end credits bit where she runs up and goes, give us some drugs, and then runs off.
There's
the
a bit
end.
After that as well.
Is there?
Yeah, there's another bit after that where it then cuts to the bloke that's making everyone famous, the weirdo in the office at the beginning, who had a really great bit at the beginning that I really like, where he doesn't realise that Billy Byers is in the office, turns around to his secretary and goes, can you come in and give me a quick one off the wrist, love? Oh, shit, sorry, hello, mate, come on in. Yeah, he's sat there and you see it pans over to who he's talking to, and it turns out he's talking to Jason Isaacs, which could have set something up or made me go, ooh, if I'd had a fucking clue what was going on for the entire
film. I didn't
film.
See that bit. That sounds just as pointless as the other thing.
That's about another minute or so of credits. Mate, what the actual bollocks.
Also, this film is 2 hours long.
Yes, it is.
It fucking is.
And it has its moments. There are some really funny moments in the film, but it's not a comedy.
No.
It's just bizarre and
it's clearly,
and it's worse, boring.
Yeah. It's clearly like Norrington had this idea of what he wanted to say. He's making a statement with this film, I think it is the fragility of fame. And like,
was the statement, I have 5 years left in cinema at best?
It's like, he's clearly trying to say something, but it's just a mess.
It is messy.
Absolute mess.
It is.
But the fact it's ended up being literally an allegory for his Hollywood career, like once he's behind the camera, is fucking impressive.
But then he never really hit the highs that even his main character supposedly hits, I guess.
Oh, even no, I've danced off my tits in a nightclub, mate.
So it is very boring. And as I say, all the fancy editing and style in the world doesn't make up for the plot.
Yeah, of which there isn't one, really.
It's a series of events, isn't
yeah.
it?
Like, yeah.
It makes no...
And it does, like I said, it's very Trainspotting, Lock, Sock, got that kind of fast edit vibe to it, but just not interesting in any way.
Like when the big gunfight at the end does happen, it's so out of context or out of time with the rest of the film. I was always sat there going, like, is this actually... And again, it goes on for a fucking while, right?
So the pacing is off, the tone is off. Well, the tone's all over the place.
The acting is just all over the place as well.
Spotty at best.
Yeah. So, like I say, Isaacs, every time Isaacs is on screen, he's brilliant.
Yeah, like, he's by far, like by a country mile, the best thing about this film.
Yeah. Mm. But his character just doesn't make any sense at all in the narrative. But yeah, he's great. Mm. Beasley is irritating.
So the only relatable person in it, really, is Kate Ashford.
His girlfriend.
Yeah, she just loses her shit with him and goes, I've fucking had enough, and just gets up and walks out. And you're like, you could go, I'm going to watch it to the end.
Yeah.
I would have loved it if, like, at the end she was... Like, if he burst into the office and she was the next big thing. Or
giving him one off the wrist.
Like. Yeah. She was the secretary. No. But yeah, if like they'd ended it and like she had been like the next one to be famous or whatever, like, that would have been cool, but no.
No. I couldn't really find any information on this film other than like what we have.
It's largely ignored by everything. So,
I do know it grossed worldwide. Anyone want to guess?
£60.
What was the budget?
I don't know.
No.
Couldn't even find that out.
I'm guessing it didn't make money. So whatever the budget was, I'm going to say it made 60% of that.
I don't know what the budget was, but it made $3,000.
Fuck, wow.
Yes.
We did him a favour by stealing it.
It's the type of film that Channel 4 might have shown
at 11 o'clock at night. Like 20 years ago when it came out, yeah.
There are art students I know that aren't pretentious enough to watch this.
Oh, yeah. it's pretentious is the right word for it. It's a really... misled vanity project
that no one saw. Not even the tagline from the director of Blade could sell this film. It was so under the radar. It's like, I don't even know what studio made this. I'm assuming independent. But it was like, you could have made Blade 2. Instead, you went with this. So we're all going to ignore that because you didn't make Blade 2 for us.
But even when you look it up on IMDb, the thumbnail they use isn't like a movie poster or anything.
It's just a VHS cover, isn't it? From like 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's the shot of Max Beasley's weird face, like from later on in the film. And from the maker of Blade, from the director of Blade, like at the bottom, and that's it. Like, it's just odd.
Yeah.
So even it took me a while to figure out what the actual title was referring to as well. I mean, obviously now I get it, like it's the countdown, you've got to get everything in before the last minute of your life. And you're like...
Well, that's that nonsensical drivel that he fucking spouts at the beginning.
I literally switched off halfway through that.
Yeah.
And then that's how much the film grabbed me. And
also, that whole bit at the beginning where he's doing all that stuff and then some girl walks in with a canoe and there seems to be snow coming in.
I'm guessing he's in Greenland. Yeah.
But it cuts away from his monologue to go and do some, like, help the girl with the thing, but you never find out
what it was.
Who that is, or, yeah.
And then he re-edits his monologue as if he's re-recording it for us, like...
Yeah.
It's very like you need to build the fourth wall before you can fucking break it, mate. Like,
it's a bag of shite.
Yeah, it was awful, not good.
Really, really bad.
Makes you wonder. I mean, like we all like Blade 2 and Del Toro's version, but it does make you wonder what you could have done instead of this.
Anything.
Yeah,
but I think it does draw a picture of where he might have been sort of mentally, where he's like, okay, we've made Blade is successful, and all of a sudden he's like, I'm good enough now to make this my passion project.
Yeah, it's like you're not though.
Yeah, you're not though. It does beg the question, like, was he starting to get a bit above himself?
Well, he first got a reputation on the set of Blade as being, quote, difficult to work with.
Right.
That's from David S. Goyer. He said when he met him, he instantly started making fun of Goyer's tattoos and saying that real men or real hard men had piercings, and then started showing off his piercings to Goyer and just kind of berating David S. Goyer. And David S. Goyer said, that's Steven in a nutshell.
I have both piercings and tattoos, definitely not a hard man.
Yeah, he's clearly an odd bloke. But I went into this thinking there were I'd heard the stories about the next movie we were talking about, thinking like he might have been a bit of a victim. But like after seeing this, you do start to question. You know, I think he was the maestro of his own demise.
Possibly, but yes. Stephen Norrington was not done with Hollywood, and in a moment we shall talk about the last film he made and the one that ended it all. Not just for him. We'll be back. Right, so after Mr. Norrington had the success of Blade and then went and made his passion project, which sucked, Hollywood called again.
Yes.
Saying, right, you've done your stupid movie, now come back and let's make a real one. Come on now, Stephen.
Get off the ceiling, you've had your fun.
Yes, and he was hired to direct The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, or LXG.
Yeah.
Which
sounds like a bad like deodorant.
Also, extraordinary begins with an E, not an X. Just saying. Just
I bet it would be called leg.
Which is probably what let's abbreviate it. Leg. Let's not change that.
Let's change English. Coming this summer from the author, Alan Moore. And the director of Blade, starring Sean Connery. Leg!
From the author, Adam Moore. No. He says it's not by him.
This version fucking
it's Alan Moore.
Ah, but it is. His name is in the credits of this film.
This is the last film.
Is it?
This is the last film he had his name on.
Yes.
Wow. So, I'm amazed that it's still on there, because like, famously he just removed his name from everything.
And we're about to find out why.
Yep. This film caused the end of a few things, but yes, LXG from 2003, as they're based on the graphic novels by Alan Moore and directed by Stephen Norrington. It stars Sean Connery, yes. Stuart Townsend, Peter Wilson, Jason Fleming, Nasser Rodin-Shah, Tony Curran, Shane West, and Richard Roxburgh. The plot of this would be
nonsense.
In an alternate Victorian age world, a group of famous contemporary fantasy, science fiction, and adventure characters team up on a secret mission.
That they do.
Mm-hmm.
The mission, not totally clear, but they do.
Now, the premise of this and the comics that it's based on, this should have been an easy sort of success.
Before we go on, I should point out this went into pre-production before the first book came out.
Really?
Yes. So, hold your horses there a little bit.
Well, no, that was before the first collected edition came out.
No, before
the actual first comic.
Before the first comic came out.
Oh, Lord.
Because the producer had just made From Hell.
Right.
And he called up Alan Moore and said, what are you working on? He was working on it at the time.
Right.
When this film went into pre-production.
That explains a lot.
Yep.
Yes.
I wonder how far through the movie they read the first book and went, Jesus, Alan!
Yeah, but I mean, the comic series went on for a while.
Mm.
Like, I think Zany just recently stopped it.
I only read the first two collected editions, but they were both fantastic.
I've read a few bits and pieces. I haven't read a lot, I have to admit. But I did start buying the collected editions, and they were. I really enjoyed them. Like, I love the whole idea of it, like taking different characters from various fantasy novels and like literary characters and putting them in, like,
and making them have sex, like he did with that other book.
But yeah, I know. Okay, Moore is not always.
Alan Moore is a weird man.
He is a very weird man. But he's also responsible for some really comics like Watchmen,
Killing Joke.
I just wanted to clarify. I don't want to sound insane. Alan Moore did write a book where he took. Alice from Alice in Wonderland, Wendy from Peter Pan, and a couple of other female characters, and made them all lesbian lovers.
Yeah.
We can all write fanfic, Alan.
Yeah. I mean, he's not quite Garth Ennis, but...
Yeah, Jesus.
Anyway, this film, it starts off in 1899... Well, the whole film's set in
1899. Yeah. Turn of the century.
Yeah, we start with a tank in London.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, old-timey bobbies versus a tank.
Yes.
Tank wins.
Yes. And it's the Germans.
It is.
And they are robbing gold from a bank.
And we get a very Austin Powers, Deadpool, Zamboni steamroller death from a copper who just stands there like, you're not in Tiananmen Square, mate. Get out of the fucking way. No. Okay.
Mm.
It does instantly confuse me, this film, because it opens up with basically Nazis.
Mm. Yep.
Now,
but it's not, because
Nazis weren't around.
Weren't
around in 1899.
They're just German soldiers.
Yeah.
Not all Germans are Nazis.
I mean, obviously, they're only meant to be dressed up as as part of their plot to make people think it was the Germans. But they're all speaking very convincing German in German accents and looking very German.
Looking very Nazi.
Looking very Nazi.
Mm. And we have our main villain. We get a glimpse of him. He's a guy called the Phantom.
Yeah.
Spelt incorrectly.
Got like a Phantom of the Opera mask going on.
He has, yes. We then cut to Berlin, where the Phantom is there in his mask, and he blows up some Zeppelins.
With the British army this time.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah. And he does it with a harpoon.
Well, it's a rocket with attached to the... It's weird.
It's a fucking harpoon. They didn't have rocket launchers. It's a harpoon with a red tip, which is why I'm guessing it catches fire. Look. Because I've always taken the piss out of that. And again, I've seen this film a few times because I'm an idiot.
Yeah. I don't feel like I've had that much time to waste.
In this lockdown.
Yeah. I mean, this was a film I never really thought I'd watch twice. And the only reason
was
because of this. otherwise, I would never have watched this film again after the first time I saw it.
I haven't seen it since Netflix came out, right? I haven't seen it
in 1890.
I haven't seen it since Love Film was a thing, and they used to mail you the CDs.
So, the Phantom is going around doing bad stuff. Cut to Kenya.
Yeah.
Where we are introduced to Alan Quatermain, played by Sir Sean Connery. Yeah.
First of all, Nigel Hemmings has a little bit of a cameo playing
pretend Alan Quatermain. Yes, and there's some stiff upper lip bloke who's talking to Alan. He's like, "The Empire needs you."
Oh, yeah, overacting, like really sort of having it
or something. Read.
Mm. And it turns out the world is heading for war.
But who are we going to go to war with? Everyone. The Nazis.
The Germans.
Mm.
And then I think some Germans show up, but they look like cowboys with armour.
They look like Ned Kelly.
Yeah. No, well, not they look, fully Ned Kellyed.
No, they've got armour.
The full-on Ned Kelly comes later.
Yeah.
Yeah, some
cowboys... With machine guns.
Yeah, some people with machine guns and armour show up, and old people get shot.
Yeah,
in this kind of bar, this kind of expat bar.
But old man Alan Quatermain beats them all up.
Yes. And then one of them runs away.
Yes.
And he's really far away. And the stiff upper lip blokes, but he's so far away.
Yeah,
and
just to establish that far away.
Alan Quatermain's a really, really good shot.
Yeah, because he shoots him even though he's far away.
Yes, and he kills him. Well, he doesn't kill him.
No, he
wounds
him.
Doesn't mean to kill him.
Yeah, he never wanted to kill him, even though he's so far away.
Yeah.
So he wounds him from far away.
He wounds him.
At this point, these guys have already had a brilliant chance to kill Alan Quatermain because the guy pins him to a wall with three knives and he's got a fourth knife in his hand, and instead of throwing it at him from a safe distance, he runs at him and gets taken out of one punch.
Yeah. He gets in arm's length of Sean Connery.
Oh, no.
Should have. Sorry.
Bring your knife to a gunfight.
Bringing yourself to a fist fight.
Should we just get all the impressions out of the way now?
He's in the library when it collapses. I can only blame myself.
Should have married to the Marx Brothers.
Shingles, you say.
To the stars.
Anyway.
That's all for Rosie.
So, yeah, the guy who is wounded takes the cyanide pill and kills himself. Oh, no.
Yeah.
And Cormain's like, I'm not doing this. And then his bar blows up.
Yeah,
but I'm doing this.
Like, wow. Explosion. And then the guy goes like, I know you won't do it for the Empire. Goes, but I know you love Africa. So basically, because Adam loves colonised Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Not Africa as such. British owned Africa.
Yeah.
Then he's in.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also they blown up his bar.
Yeah. So he's got nothing else to do.
I've nowhere to drink now. Might as well go off to London. Back to London we go.
With the really, you get the unnecessary Phileas Fogg reference.
Yes.
Phileas Fogg is actually a character that turns up in some of the other books.
Ah, right.
It's just weird. He goes, oh, you made good time. And he goes, it's not like Phileas Fogg, around the world in 80 days. Okay.
I saw that Steve Coogan movie.
So we now meet M. Not the James Bond M. He's just someone else called M.
Wonder what that could stand for.
Well, and he's there like, listen, I'm going to put together a league of gentlemen
that are extraordinary.
Who are extraordinary, and you're going to do a thing that's going to stop this phantom, that's going to stop the world war happening.
Like
you're
the down? Avengers? No.
No, we saw that film and it was shit. Right. Yes.
I just wanted to hear Sean Connery say initiative.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen initiative.
So, then we meet Captain Nemo.
Yeah.
Who, then we meet a Cockney Invisible Man.
Yeah.
But not, the Invisible Man, because they couldn't get the rights from H.G. Wells.
Yeah, so this is a guy who stole... The original Invisible Man died, and this guy... What's his name?
I can't
Skinner.
Remember.
Skinner stole
his formula.
The formula.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So if you can't get the rights to a character, kill him and rip him off.
Yeah.
And then we meet Mrs. Harker, mm-hmm. who is Mina Harker, a.k.a. the wife of Jonathan Harker from Dracula. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, in the books that I've read, by the way, at no point does she do anything vampire-y.
Oh, yeah, she's a vampire
in the
books.
She is a vampire in the books.
No, she is a vampire in the books, but you never act in the first two editions that I've seen. You never see her go full fan.
She also leads the team.
She does, yes, because she's fucking Wellard.
Yeah.
It's her and Hyde, pretty
much. But in this, she does not, because Sean Connery costs more money.
Yeah.
So we're going to need him to lead the team.
Well, if they found him like they found him in the comics, it's a lot more like they find Brendan Fraser in The Mummy, except he's smacked off his tits in some prison cell in the middle of colonised Africa.
So that's the team so far.
Also, Alan Quatermain seems to hate women as much as Sean Connery hates women.
Yes.
Please tell me this is Harker's wife with a chic note.
So that's the team, and then they need to recruit two more. So they go outside, and it turns out that Captain Nemo has invented cars.
Yeah, I call it an automobile.
I did look this up. Apparently cars were invented before 1800.
They were, but not like this.
Not like this.
No.
You know, these fucking Batmobile figures.
Yeah.
No. And they go off to get Dorian Gray from...
The shittest Lestat turns up as Dorian
Stuart
Gray.
Townsend is awful in everything I've seen him in.
He's all right in Shooting Fish.
No, he's not.
Fair enough.
I don't like him at all. I've never liked him. There's a reason you don't see him in anything anymore.
He's especially... he's worse in this... then Queen of the Damned.
Yes,
I
he think. Is. I'll, yeah. No, I'll agree.
He is terrible.
He gets some bollocks lines anyway.
He's,
but he's
so utterly charmless.
Yeah, his quips are just the worst. It's like he's like family dinner, and you've got that uncle that thinks he's funny, and it's just like the whole table's silent every time he speaks. That's his character. That's Dorian Gray.
They've decided that Dorian Gray is basically Oscar Wilde-ish.
Yeah.
Like, what's Dorian Gray like? Well, I've got the book, but I can't be asked to read it. But it says it's by Oscar Wilde, and he was a bit wry, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Let's just make it that. Great, done.
He's only in this movie so that the bad guys have got someone to shoot at all the time. They want a bullet sponge.
So those that don't know the story is Dorian Gray is invincible.
Can't die.
He cannot die. He cannot age.
His essence is essentially caught in a painting of him.
Yeah. Yes, it's like ages
painting,
for him.
The painting ages... But he doesn't.
Yes.
It's like a kind of Faustian thing.
Yeah, so it will only be undone if he ever lays eyes on his own portrait.
Mm-hmm. Also in this scene, we see the Invisible Man drink some whiskey.
And you see it go down his throat.
Yeah, which is weird. Does that mean you can see, like, the shit in his intestine as well?
I was going to ask, but I was scared to.
Well, you'd assume it would just pool up in whatever is in his stomach. Mm. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
So, he's invisible, but he's... It's also see-through. It doesn't make sense.
They never do it again. Like, it's
no, they don't.
Just that one bit.
No. Anyway, so they're there to get Dorian Gray. And the Phantom shows up to give his join me speech.
Yeah. Just wandered into Dorian Gray's house.
Yeah. With his army of men.
Yeah.
Silently.
Silently. The speech doesn't go very well. No, and they have a big fight.
Yeah.
A fight in which Captain Nemo takes on four gunmen with a sword.
Die! They're polite enough to stop and tell him that he can draw his weapon if he wants to, and rather than saying anything, he just, I walk a different path.
Yeah.
And then proceeds to really, badly swing a sword in their
sword
vague direction.
And not get hit by all the bullets. Yeah, but they shoot guns and miss each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Dorian Gray just wanders about in a circle in the middle of the room. Just stabbing people and getting shot.
And apparently he doesn't really take any hits until the last guy. He's like right up in front of him. So he's like, just in case you any shadow of a doubt, ruin his jacket.
And Mina reveals herself to be a vampire. And we're also introduced to Tom Sawyer.
Yeah.
Tom Sawyer, who is a US Secret Service agent, despite the fact that he is 12 years old. He's not, but he looks it.
Yeah.
But he is snuck in disguised as one of the Germans. Because he's onto them. because America has a vested interest. So they sent their top man, this boy,
Tom Sawyer, who before this just hung about on a river.
Yeah,
his friend Jim is nowhere to be seen.
There is, I believe, was there a deleted scene, or it's mentioned in the book that his friend Huck Finn was killed. Who was also an agent.
In the book it's mentioned, for sure. Yeah.
So he joins. I don't know who you are.
In the book they mention Huck Finn. I believe Tom Sawyer wasn't in any either of the ones I read.
Tom Sawyer was added by the film to make it appeal more to American audiences.
Yeah, I don't think he was ever in any of the books.
No, he wasn't.
Dorian Gray wasn't until much later on.
Mm.
Yeah, they did. They took a few liberties with the lineup and plot and
visual style.
Well, again, even like the Invisible Man, you know his introduction in the comics.
I can't remember.
Him raping a nun in the middle of a church.
Wow.
He's a rapist.
Alan Moore, ladies and gentlemen, Alan Moore.
And what is it?
Acclaimed, award-winning.
I will wait until we meet the next character before I tell you all about him. But G-Bus.
So now they've got a little team. There's one more to get. And he's in Paris, so they get in the Nautilus, the famous Nautilus.
Yeah. Mm.
Captain Nemo's submarine, which in this film is the size of a building.
Also, it turns up in the dock in the middle of London.
The East End dock.
It rises, from an East End dock. It rises from out of the water. That dock is not that fucking deep.
No, it's not that fucking wide, is it?
This
it's massive.
Nautilus. So it's when I say the size of a building, I don't mean like a fucking Starbucks.
No.
I mean an office block.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Well, they call it the sword of the sea, don't they? And it's always made to look a bit like a sword because it's got that long pointy thing at the end.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's got to be at least like, what, 7 stories high?
Oh, minimum.
20
yeah.
something long.
It does look kind of cool. But
it looks great.
Fucking
but it is
big.
Huge.
It's too big.
Yeah,
it's
no,
ridiculous.
Absolutely. I've always dreamed of you saying that to me, but yes.
So they head to Paris to get Mr. Hyde and Dr. Jekyll.
Again, slightly different way of meeting this dude as well.
And he's running around the rooftops of Paris. This is as Mr. Hyde.
Mm.
And with his giant hat.
Yeah.
Which
still fits on his bulbous giant monkey.
Well, it is shown later, isn't it? That they capture him in a net, essentially, and drag him into the Nautilus. And as they do, Mr. Hyde's top hat falls off.
Mm.
And Tom Sawyer picks it up, and it is like the size of about the diameter of, say, twice the size of a dinner plate.
Yeah.
So he has purposely had a very large hat made for him.
But not his suit.
For when he turns into Mr. Hyde.
Mm.
Okay.
He just leaves somewhere to pick up.
I will say the Mr. Hyde effects, the way they did it, is fucking impressive.
It's pretty fucking
cool.
It
does look great.
There's some good practical effects.
And
it reminds me a bit, it reminds me of some of the visuals in Blade.
Mm.
Where it sort of flashes and it changes. I can't remember specifically in Blade, but it does. You can see the visual style that is Norrington's in that.
Yeah, and when he kind of de-transforms,
it's
like a de-transformation scene. It is quite cool.
Mm.
It does look pretty good.
Because he doesn't kind of like do it smoothly. It's like one arm goes, then one hand goes, then
half of his face
goes,
is like stretched over. So yeah, all of the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde stuff is really cool.
Yeah,
I think it looks fantastic.
Yeah, he basically eats and rapes and kills prostitutes.
I have read that. Yeah.
Wow.
Why was there no R-rated version of this film? Oh wait,
because we have this instead.
Wah.
Now they've got the whole team together, and off they're going to go in the Nautilus to Venice. Not before they're on top of the Nautilus as it's sailing along. Also, Mina the vampire can survive sunlight, no problem.
Yeah, well, because she's going to be directly from Bram Stoker's book. So the vampire can go out in sunlight.
But in Blade 3, it doesn't matter, remember?
No.
You know, inconsistencies, Mr. Norrington and Mr. Moore and everybody. Get it together.
Bram Stoker.
Yeah. You're dead fuck.
Well, isn't it like since Nosferatu, really, the whole sunlight thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that was when it was added.
In 1922.
So the submarine dives underneath the waves. Cut to the submarine back on the surface for whatever reason, and we get some Alan Quatermain backstory.
Yeah.
And
shooting buoys. Boys. However you pronounce it.
It's definitely boys.
Is it?
It's
floating boys, not little boys.
It's just shooting boys in the water.
It's just American.
It's dark.
It's just Americans that say buoys.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
I've never been sure which one's right.
It's boys.
It's boys.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, we get some Alan Quatermain backstory. My son is dead. Yada, yada, yada.
Because he didn't train him properly or something.
He's...
Yeah, it's Alan Quartermain's fault that his son died, which is why he wants to adopt Tom Sawyer.
My favourite bit is that
fully grown Tom Sawyer.
I didn't train my son properly. I got my son killed on a mission, so fuck the British Empire.
And also, he starts training Tom Sawyer how to shoot until he just walks off.
Mm. He's like, did you train your son how to shoot like this? And it's not like he turns around and he's not there. You see him fucking sneak off in the background.
I honestly think...
turns around and walks off.
I think that there must have been a bust-up at that point, because you kind of see him in the background, but you can't even see that it's definitely Sean Connery.
No.
So I reckon there was some sort of bust-up there, and they went, we'll just pretend he walked off.
It's Stephen Norrington in the same outfit. I don't worry, lads, I've got this.
We also get the Dorian Gray backstory, which we've told you. Mm-hmm. And then he hooks up with Mina... also, everyone is trying to bang Mina, it seems.
Yeah.
Because she's the only female there.
It is odd, because they have seen her rip a guy's throat out with her mouth.
But could you imagine a bunch of guys in this day and age thirsting over a tall vampire woman? It's fucking ridiculous.
And also, it was revealed that Dr. Jekyll had time to get all of his belongings on the submarine despite being kidnapped.
Yeah.
But whatever. And someone is stealing some stuff from the submarine.
Mm. Yes. And...
they believe there is a spy and they believe it is the Invisible Man.
There's a really hammered in point where Dorian Gray scratches
the Invisible Man,
Skinner.
Better me than him.
Did you ever see the animation Queer Duck?
What?
Yes, I think I did. Yeah.
And he's got a side character called Oscar Wildcat.
Yeah.
Oscar Wildcat is just Dorian Gray, and this is just the same one. Okay, so our team now arrives in Venice. For what reason are they there?
Well, basically, they figured out that the Phantom has stolen Leonardo da Vinci's plans of Venice.
Yeah.
And that they've sussed out that if they blow up certain support columns under the city, i.e. every single one of them, they can sink Venice into the sea, and that'll kick off this world war.
There's a meeting of world leaders going on in Venice.
That's it, yeah.
And
a...
Carnival.
Fair of some... like a.
Carnival,
that's it.
Yeah. It's basically, it's the gunpowder plot times 911.
Yes.
So at this point as well, everyone thinks that Skinner is the snick, and that he's stealing everyone's, he's stolen
bits and bobs,
bits and pieces off of every character.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So they find magnesium phosphate?
One of Hyde's vials, Jekyll's Hyde vials is missing.
Mm.
So, the Nautilus arrives... the Nautilus, which is the size of a medium to large building, somehow fits down the canals of Venice.
Do you remember that meme with the train just smashing into the side of the mountain?
It's the Family Guy thing.
But they have no problem. But it's like, Captain Nemo, are we going to fit? We'll be fine as long as our destination is directly straightforward. Because we can't go around corners in this thing. And also, we'll probably have to back all the way out.
Yeah, what they never showed was when they had to back out. It's going, beep, 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 with half the crew going, keep it coming, keep it coming.
So yeah, they take this ridiculously large submarine down the canals of Venice and find a berth in Venice large enough for this thing to dock.
Well, they nearly knocked down the Bridge of Sighs, didn't they? And then they this
stop
is far enough.
Yeah.
Oh, he says, we can't go any further. So he goes, right. Waits about 10 seconds. He goes, stop.
Your head.
You see the really bad CGI propellers underneath, which look more like giant drill bits, just start turning the other way.
So they've arrived, and obviously there are bombs underwater, which they know about somehow.
Mm, there's a fucking lot of them.
Yes. And as soon as they arrive, all the bombs go off.
Yeah.
There must be more bombs.
They're too late. Right. And so, this happens. Now, I watched this last night, and I didn't really understand it, and I thought about it, and I think this is what's happening. The bombs are going off in a sequence, in a domino effect.
Yeah.
So they get the car that he invented to outrun the explosions.
Yeah.
And once they've outrun them,
mm-hmm.
he sends up a flare,
yeah,
and then they fire a rocket there to outrun them, however far away it is.
So we're
and that stops the sequence of the bombs.
Yeah, if they
up.
Blow up the bombs with another bomb, then it will stop the bombs going off.
Yeah.
Also, surely the sequence is a straight line.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
So, surely they can just, if it's a domino effect, you just kind of watch where it's blowing up and go, okay, let's say 500 yards past the next one, that's where we'll go
yeah.
with a rocket and stop it.
Right, you know that but habit no. we've got of thinking about things more than the scriptwriters? We've actually just explained it better than the scriptwriters yeah. as well.
Also, by the time they do...
It still doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
By the time they do manage to stop the bombs, mm. half of Venice is fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least.
At
oh,
least.
I don't know. But yeah, they go off and like, on in the car to chase after the explosions.
No matter how fast this car is going, you can jump out and land standing.
Everyone takes it in turns to yeah. jump out and land.
So first is Dorian okay. Gray. He's like, I got this, hops out. Like Mina, fair enough, flies. She flies off yeah. and turns into bats. I quite
does
like
she turn into
bit.
A bat or some bats?
A
or
bat, surrounded
many,
by
many bats.
Bats
but
yeah.
she is just vamping it up in the middle.
Yeah.
Of
yeah. And then 71-year-old Sean Connery leaps out of a moving car and lands
perfectly.
Like a fucking gymnast.
Yeah.
Yes.
10 points.
It is quite funny. This is where I think the second point in this film where Tom Sawyer does his double gun action.
Yeah.
And cannot actually hit anything.
No.
And you just get Sean Connery go, sit down, you buffoon. Mm. Which is kind of what the audience think, like, just sit down, you twat.
Apart from Mina, who does seem to go a bit moist about it.
Mm.
She's like, hello.
It is weird that also the entire route of the exploding buildings, all the buildings are lined with henchmen shooting yeah. at them, despite the fact that they'll be killed in the explosion, surely?
Yeah.
Whatever. And also...
So imagine blowing up something.
They're all okay with
men.
Being expendable.
Mina turns into a kind of wave of bats, as we mentioned.
Mm.
And as they're driving along, she's taking out henchmen. And Sean Connery says, like, oh, we've got some help up there. But if you notice, it's really obvious in the film that she is behind the car. So the car, once she's taking out the henchmen
after they've
after the car has passed,
mm.
making what she's doing completely pointless.
Yep.
You want to get in front to stop them shooting at them in the first place.
Can't have Tom Sawyer looking up her vampire skirt while she's flying though.
Stupid.
Yes.
Yeah, not very well thought through, Norrington.
Or whoever wrote the script.
Whoever fucking wrote it.
Alan Moore. No, you're
right. They'll put a spell on you.
So, okay, whatever. So
Alan has his moment with the Phantom,
mm.
who knows everything about him and his son.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the rocket works, by the way. Their ridiculous plan does work.
Their laser-guided rocket that hits the flare. Like, what? How the fuck is it even like zoning in on the right spot? And how the fuck does Tom Sawyer survive that crash into the museum, which it's then explodes?
Also... I don't know if you guys know this. Mm. Submarines don't really have windows. So when Captain Nemo gives the orders to fire to the guy in the fucking, you know, rocket button pushing room downstairs, fire is like, where? Just push it anyway. Fuck it.
So I've got a periscope. Surely just come with the periscope's aiming.
Oh, of all, this film is ridiculous, but that whole sequence is just so dumb.
Yeah.
Everything about it.
It's just action over any
style
kind
of
substance. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of Venice just is pretty much destroyed.
Well, yeah, because Alan does that bit with the family. He goes, sure, you failed. I was like, well...
But yeah,
he's destroyed a lot.
He goes like, Venice still stands.
Does it though?
What's left of it?
It's crawling at best through with its own entrails in its hands.
So yeah, Phantom and Alan Quatermain have a little graveyard interaction.
Yeah.
Which is actually taken from a scene from Phantom of the Opera.
Right.
Continue. Oh.
Mm. And it turns out that the Phantom isn't a Phantom.
Oh, no, it's M. Yeah.
It's M.
Yeah.
It's just M wearing makeup.
Yeah.
A mask and makeup.
Mm.
But we've also been given a hint earlier on that his name is James because one of his henchmen is like, run, James! Yeah. So we know his name is James and M. So if you haven't figured it out by now...
Yeah.
Then you've never...
Well, wait like 10 minutes and we'll tell you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's revealed that M is the Phantom, so why had the whole Phantom get up and what is... Whatever. It's,
yeah.
Well, no, whatever. And it turns out that Dorian Gray is actually the spy.
Shock.
Not yet.
What?
The really kind of up himself piece of shit. It turns out to be the bad guy?
Yeah.
No.
Also, the way you find out, he turns up on the submarine to that one guy.
Ishmael.
And he's like, oh, Ishmael, that's it. And he's like, oh, you're the first one back. And he's like,
well, hi,
he goes, oh, that's Skinner, eh? And he goes, Skinner? No, me. And shoots him. for no reason other than the fact that this guy can wander out bleeding and go, "It's Dorian Gray!"
Yeah. Like he shoots him three times, so you probably think, yeah, you should probably be dead from that. But, oh, no, no. Temporary plot armour?
I mean, remember how big this sub is as well, so yeah. It's taken him 25 minutes to get from wherever he was to outside to go, "It's Dorian Gray!"
Fuck, he couldn't have shot me next to the med bay, could he?
So then Dorian Gray escapes in an escape pod, which shoots out the side of the Nautilus and looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
And he looks all evil in the little porthole, like, like fucking Dr. Robotnik at the end of a level, like,
twirling a moustache.
Yeah. Kind of like Atlas Spheres things they've got in Jurassic Park. It's like one of those sliced in half with metallic teeth.
Yes, yeah, that are the propellers.
It doesn't even look like it would work.
No, it doesn't. I mean, how bottom heavy does that thing have to be? Like, fucking hell.
So that he fucks off, and then they all get in the Nautilus, and we do actually see the Nautilus reverse out of the fucking canal.
Next hour and 40 minutes of the film.
The director's cut is a spectacular travel warden's wet dream.
So once they're then on the Nautilus, they can get a recording.
An LP that can play fucking video footage.
Wow, a novelty flying disc. No, it's actually a musical disc, and he just happens to have a gramophone in that room, and they play it, but it also plays a video.
I don't think it's supposed to...
Like, I think the video's just there for the audience.
Yeah, for the audience.
Mm. Yeah.
Fucking knows, man. Never mind, with everything else going on, I could easily believe that was what they actually wanted us to think.
So it's a recording of M basically talking about his evil plot, and the League doesn't actually exist. It never existed.
Yeah.
Why he put them together in the same room, I don't understand.
No idea at all.
It's like, I could get...
Basically, his life would have been much easier and his plan would have come together a lot better if he hadn't put these people together in the first place.
One-on-one interviews, surely.
Or just never met them.
Yeah, because they were all fairly, didn't really want to do this for various
reasons.
Yeah,
the League wasn't a real thing, as he's disclosed. Yeah. So why put it together just so that you can fight him?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. But that's what he's done. Oh, and also, there's bombs on the submarine.
Because of bombs.
Yeah, which leads to another Dorian Gray pun extraordinaire, bomb voyage.
Yeah. Fuck off.
It's like a...
just die.
It's like a wrestling promo where he's like, M's there in the foreground, like, "Yo, it never existed, I fooled you all, you suckers!" And then in the background, he's like, "Bomb voyage!" It's fucking ridiculous.
He goes, yeah, if you haven't figured it out... Dorian Gray's the spy, and he's like, "Growl." Yeah. Weird.
Oscar Wildcat here. it is bad. So the bombs go off, but no one dies, apart from a few generic kind of submariners that no one really cares for.
Nemo's men, they shut the door on some men they could definitely save. Yeah. Like, they're right there.
But for the greater good, we must seal them in! Yeah. It's like, just say you're short on food, bro.
This is where you get the Mr. Hyde hero.
Yeah.
Hero moment.
He saves the day. Saves it from sinking somehow, whatever.
He does some stuff.
He flushes the toilet, basically, and the whole thing.
Essentially, yeah. They fix the Nautilus.
Oh, is it really handy, by the way? The handles that he has to use are exactly Hyde-sized.
Yeah. That's like a two-hand job for most people.
Yeah.
Not for me.
You need two men, at least. No, I have got this, gents. Don't worry. And apparently he can breathe underwater for fucking ages.
Well, yeah.
I'm assuming his lungs are a lot bigger.
Yeah.
So anyway, they fix that.
And they fix the Nautilus by teamwork.
Yep.
Yeah.
Get a teamwork montage.
And they head to... Is it Mongolia or North Cambodia?
Somewhere snowy.
I thought it was the Arctic.
No, it's round the top of Japan they go or something like that.
I just assumed it was the Arctic.
I assume it's Siberia because that weird tiger turns up.
But yeah, I thought it must be
somewhere
like
Asian
that.
And cold.
Yeah. Alan Moore really likes to put his villains in snowy places, as far as I can tell. He's pretty, like, if you go a little bit further over the hill, you've just got Ozymandias just chilling out trying to fuck over Dr. Manhattan.
So, they head off to a place we can't remember, where it's snowing.
Siberia, maybe.
Yeah. Something like, I don't know. And there is a fortress. And as soon as the fortress came up on screen, I wrote down, I bet it blows up.
I mean, it's already got big fucking flames coming out of all the chimneys. It's all like this kind of like Taj Mahal kind of tops to all of them.
Mm. It's not obviously... Also, how they knew he was there... I think it's explained.
Yeah, the invisible man is sending them Morse code because he snuck into the pod with Skinner.
Surprise, it wasn't me who was the spy. It was.
But you thought it was, so I chose to like just go silent.
I've literally been silent.
I knew you wouldn't been here believe the whole time. Me because I've been shifty as fuck this entire time. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't believe me. Would you believe me?
No.
So yeah, then you get all the exposition about what they're doing. Like Emma's building stuff based on bits and pieces of them,
and they're trying to create their own like invisible spies,
building another Nautilus. Not a lie.
Yeah.
Not gonna lie.
It's not a lie, mate. Yeah.
So yeah, they're building a kind of a robot army like the Ned Kelly stuff. Yeah. They're building an evil version of the Nautilus and clones.
Many Nautilus, the Nautili.
Nautili. Mm-hmm. And clones of the extraordinary people.
Well, I think they're trying to just get their powers into other people, aren't they?
Like, yeah. Kind of like that. So they're there, held up in a cave. They get there and they wait in the cave for
fucking ages.
Only so Alan can have that tiger moment.
Yeah.
And so that the Invisible Man can show up and thank fuck they brought that extra coat.
Yeah.
Yeah, also
the Invisible Man. Well, they've all taken it in turns to carry. They're like, fucking, why are we carrying this? Isn't he
in case Skinner shows up. And he does show up, completely butt naked, and somehow doesn't have hypothermia.
It's sub-zero fucking temperatures.
They give him a coat.
He pinches Mina's ass when he shows up, doesn't he? And he's like, also, I can't feel any of my extremities.
Throughout this film, the Invisible Man, so we can see him, he wears, every now and then, puts makeup on his face.
Yeah.
The white kind of gloss or whatever it is. But he shows up butt naked, but has that white...
Somewhere. He's concealed
that makeup on his person somewhere.
I mean, how many places are there on the human body to hide that?
I think, honestly, he's turned around to Mina and had a bit of a girly moment and being like, Dad, can I just see your foundation for just 1 second? Like,
yeah.
Does himself up in the cave and apparently has sunglasses.
No,
up his ass.
It was in his bum.
It was in his bum. His prison wallet.
And so begins the third act.
Ooh, boy.
Now, in short, basically, they go in, they fight, everything blows up, the good guys win.
Mm.
Yeah. And we find out that M is Moriarty.
Yes, in case you didn't guess it, M is Dr. Moriarty. It's just big, lots of fighting. Again, Nemo fighting people who are heavily armed with guns, with a sword, and not dying. And also, when it's revealed that M is actually Moriarty, his accent changes.
Yeah, it goes all like, fuck off, mate, innit?
Yeah, he sort of speaks, hello, I'm M.
Oh, yeah.
And then once it's revealed he's Moriarty, like, oh, you fucking guessed it,
Sherlock Holmes is fucking...
Like Nemesis spoke like a Cockney gangster.
Yep.
Danny Dyer's a director.
Fucking hell, Sherlock, you cunt.
Mina and Dorian Gray have a fight. And that Dorian Gray has a terrible CGI death.
That did make me chuckle. There's a couple of lines
bad.
In that line.
It's bad CGI.
No, you got the line, was it, where they sort of fucking each other up. We're going to be at this all day.
Oh, yeah, I did like that.
And then she stabs him in the bollocks as well. It's like, if that had been permanent, I would have been very upset.
There's more Tom Sawyer double gun action where he can't hit anything.
Yeah, well, in his defence, he does have to shoot a rifle at an invisible dude as well.
And then we get a roided up Mr. Hyde, but it's a different guy.
Mega
Hyde. One of the henchmen takes a load of Dr. Jekyll's fucking potion.
But he's forgotten how to drink. Like, he just pours it on his face.
I giggled. He's like, I had to take it. No, not the whole bottle. Like, look at him. That was not the whole bottle.
Yeah, look.
He drank less than you would drink.
Yeah. The rest of it is on his shirt.
And then he turns into one of the Titans from Arkham Asylum.
Yeah, it is very Arkham Asylum, isn't it? They have a big old CGI fight.
One of the things
fight.
From Attack on Titan. It's just fucking roided up.
Fucking
mental guys.
And unsurprisingly, the fortress blows up.
Because the good guys are still in it, because apparently blowing up places while your own men is the fucking order.
Yeah, Skinner plants bombs everywhere, and they all seem to forget that was happening, and are still inside when it blows up.
Yeah.
So, well, it worked for the bad guys, didn't it? They blow up Venice while all their men are on the right buildings. Why don't we try it?
Alan Quatermain and Moriarty having a fight. Moriarty stabs Quatermain and jumps out the window. Tom Sawyer shows up.
He Batmans to the floor as well with his magic cloak.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
And obviously he's really far away.
What?
But Quatermain's glasses are broken, so he can't shoot. So it's up to Tom Sawyer.
And he's been stabbed in the back.
Yes. It's up to Tom Sawyer to shoot him from a long old distance. Yeah. And Quatermain's like, you could shoot now because I say so.
Yeah.
You're ready, boy.
Because plot.
Yeah, because plot, and he shoots him and kills
him. But he's really far away. Don't worry. I've taught you to shoot things really far away.
Do you remember that time
away.
I walked away?
Yeah.
Thank fucking.
I didn't tell you anything.
Thank fucking he was right next to that hole in the ice as well, so he could drop everything useful into that hole in the ice.
Yep.
I mean, that's Sawyer waited until he was next to that hole in the ice.
I've been ready for hours. hours.
He is far away, but is he far away enough?
He's far away enough to fucking die. Mm. And we turn around and Alan Quatermain dies.
No.
Cut to Kenya.
Colonised Africa.
Colonised Africa, where they are burying Alan Quatermain in the ground next to his dead wife, child, whatever, don't care.
Well, he's buried many women, so, I mean, it's one of his wives.
He did say, yeah, very true wives and many lovers. Yeah, I'm not looking for another either.
I've smacked around a lot of women.
Mm. And what were the causes of death? Your own fucking business. That's what I mind
it. You'll find out.
So, they bury him, and everyone's there. Mina's there. Dr. Jekyll's there. Invisible Man is there. Tom Sawyer's there.
Yeah.
Captain Nemo's there. And they're all there. And they bury him, and they go, okay, he's at rest now. And they all turn around, and they walk off into the fucking wilderness.
Yeah. And also, Tom Sawyer gives him back the rifle
that wasn't his
to begin with.
Yeah, Tom Sawyer gave it to him. Yeah.
He's like, thanks, old man, or whatever. He said, it was your gun, you fucking idiot.
It was his customised rifle that he now just
American style.
Given away.
He's like, thanks, Dad. Alan.
But yeah, they all just walk off into the wilderness.
Mm.
There's no building or transportation or anything inside.
They're going to find themselves.
Yeah.
And then, in the Kenyan wilderness.
Yeah.
And then, they'll be dead in a day.
The ground starts shaking while Bruce Wayne and Wonder Woman are crying. And
and then it is alluded to that a witch doctor is going to bring Alan back to life.
Africa will never let him die.
Africa would never let him die.
Yeah, roll credits.
Yeah, witch doctor, it's allegedly a witch doctor brings him back to life for the completely abandoned sequel.
Mm.
So that was The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Mm.
Mm.
What do you think?
So this collection of mundane Muppets wasn't a workable enough title.
It's just a mess again.
It's a fucking wasted opportunity.
Yeah, incredibly. Like the premise of it is really intriguing and a good idea.
Mm.
I mean, Moore managed to spread this out into like numerous books, and this film managed to fuck it up so badly they never wanted to make another one. To the point where they tried to reboot it not that long ago,
2013, I believe. And there was actually talks of a TV series instead of making a sequel or reboot,
which I think would have been a better idea.
Which also did not happen.
Mm.
Yeah, they still completely abandoned the whole idea.
So where did it all go wrong? The thing is, this film actually made money.
Yeah.
This was not a lot of money, but it was not a flop. It didn't make the money they expected it to, but it still made money.
I'd say the three we had to watch, I enjoyed watching this one the most.
Compared to those other two fucking films.
I actually don't hate this film. It's a mess, but I don't dislike it.
This has hit, for me, like the almost so bad it's good. Like, I actually enjoyed watching it again.
There are moments in this film that do make it worth sitting through.
But I think it's because I'm remembering it in my head the way I think scenes should have played out and not how they were on screen.
I think it's... Sean Connery is a draw, and he's quite good in it. He is kind of... reminds me, because it is that kind of action adventure, it's like him in...
Last Crusade again.
Yeah, doing that kind of thing.
Sean Connery, whatever you think of him as a person, like, he is great in a lot of films.
He has a lot of charisma.
And he's incredibly watchable.
Definitely.
And he is great in this film. Like, he has some good lines, and like, when he's on screen, he's a presence.
Absolutely. He was paid $17 million to be in this film.
Was he his executive producer on it as well?
It was as well.
Is it 17 or 18?
17 officially.
All right.
But apparently he never understood the script, which is the first problem with this film.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is he turned down before this, he turned down the Matrix.
And Lord of the Rings.
Because he didn't understand the script. Them.
And then he got a script again he didn't understand, but thought, well, hang on, that's two I've passed up.
Better do this one.
Whoopsie.
So he did it. And the other problem being Stephen Norrington didn't really know what he was doing. The biggest film he'd worked on, and this film had a huge production, huge sets, hundreds of people running around, and he could not. The director is in charge essentially of everything. Everything has to go through a director, and he couldn't fucking handle it.
Apparently, he was changing things last minute. They'd shoot a scene, and he wouldn't tell anybody why. He'd disappear because he was reworking the scene, and then he'd come back and want to do it in a completely different way.
Yeah. So, a Hollywood icon making a film he doesn't understand, and a director who doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
These two clashed on set
a lot.
They argued on set every day about everything.
Yeah.
Literally every fucking thing. Every shot, everything that was set up. It obviously got out afterwards. There were reports that, you know, all this clash happened. Apparently, the reports that came out were not only true, but in reality, it was even worse.
Yeah.
Then there's that Jason Fleming interview you talk about where
the one I looked at what Jason Fleming says. But basically, he interviewed in a magazine. He said, my favourite bust up was in Venice. He said, the league had to walk down from Nemo's boat and down the street, like in Magnificent Seven style. Said, at the end of the take, Sean shouted to Norrington, like, what? You want us to do that again? And Norrington replied, for 18 million, I don't think it's too much to ask you to walk down a road. Apparently, Connery's reply was unprintable in the magazine. So.
Yep. Yeah, they argued about everything all the fucking time. Almost became like physical. There was a scene where Norrington fucking lost it with Connery and just kept shouting at Connery, punch me in the fucking face.
I
and Connery walked off set. This happened like every day.
Fucking hell.
And this film took a long time to make. So it was a nightmare of a shoot, pretty much just because of those two.
Yeah.
It went so badly that Sean Connery retired.
Yep.
And never made a feature-length film. He did some voice work afterwards, but essentially never acted again. And Stephen Norrington retired and said he would never direct a film ever again.
Ended two careers. Although Sean Connery was in a position where he could retire anyway.
Yeah, he was in his 70s,
established, whereas Norrington's career hit its high point, probably, and ended.
Yeah, I mean, it could have gone further, but no, he kind of, like, in a way, threw his toys out of the pram.
I mean, there are other directors out there that have had films like this that have still gone on to have long careers.
Look
at David Fincher's first movie with Alien 3.
Steven Spielberg making Jaws.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It clashes with, like, big stars and stuff like that, but, I mean, this was obviously enough for Norrington to be like, nah.
Norrington didn't go to the rap party, and when somebody asked Sean Connery where he was, he said, check the local asylum. He just thought he was a fucking lunatic.
Connery was quite professional about the whole thing, to be honest, like, because
in interviews,
like, I mean, even before the film had wrapped, they was like, so I'm trying to get all these details out of him about all these arguments and stuff, and he was like, look, at the end of the day, I just want to finish the film. I just want to wrap this film, like, finish the film. So, like, he was never going to abandon the film.
No. And Norrington gave no interviews.
No.
You cannot find a Norrington interview.
No.
About this film, actually.
No.
Not even in print. I'm sure there is one, but I couldn't find one.
Are we sure he's real?
Well, he's like, what was that, Alan Smithy? Like
the fake director.
Whenever you made a film that absolutely stank,
yeah,
you take your name off it, and they put directed by Alan Smithy.
Now the new one's Stephen Norrington.
Maybe, but yeah, this film, they clashed on it so much that both men decided to essentially retire, and then the film came out and it sucked.
Yeah,
which didn't help matters. The critics fucking hated it. It didn't do as well as it should have done at the box office, and that was it.
Yeah, that was Norrington's career.
Done.
Whoopsie!
I mean, even looking it up now, there's nothing about him.
No, his last credit is from 2015, where he worked on the creature design of a film called Inanimate. He also worked on sculptors of the Exorcist prequel.
Right.
From 2004, I believe. That's it. But yeah, last film he directed was this. He said he would never direct a film again. He has allegedly since gone back on that.
Just to check, was that his choice? Or I will never direct another movie again. We know, you're blacklisted.
No.
You're fine, I quit.
Actually, he's been offered a lot of work.
Really?
Yes, I'll tell you what. But yeah, he said he would never direct again, went back on that, and as of 2021, has still not made a film. But yeah, he is still offered work and has been over the years, including Ghost Rider.
I mean, he kind of fucked it up more than Mark Johnson did.
A film based on the comics, was it Master of Kung Fu?
Yeah.
Live action version
of Shang-Chi.
Yep.
Which is what they're doing now anyway.
Yeah. Live action version of Akira.
No, get him the fuck away from that.
Yeah. The remake of Clash of the Titans.
I mean, that didn't end well.
He was attached at one point for the Crow reboot.
Fuck off. Actually, no, you know what? I think I heard about that one.
Everyone at some point has been attached to direct the reboot of the Crow. over the last 10 years.
I turned it down.
I smoked my application letter.
I'm busy being in Spider-Man 3.
That's
so.
It, aren't we all?
And at some point, there's a supernatural action thriller in the works called The Lost Patrol, which never amounted. So he's still offered work, has been offered
but
work.
But he's
over
busy
years.
Working on The Last Minute too.
But he's busy. Well, the last word I could find on anything to do with Stephen Norrington was what he's doing. It's an interview with Stephen Dorff from 2018.
Right.
Which he said Norrington is making a film in his house using miniatures, and Dorff predicted it would take him about 10 years to complete.
Porn.
Miniatures
and porn.
Midgets?
Yeah, miniatures are a lot more.
You're thinking of midget
compliant.
Porn, not miniature porn.
Look, you call them what you want, mate. Like,
no one takes 10 years to make a midget porno.
It's going to be the Lord of the Rings of the porno, except so many more rings are going to get destroyed.
That's been done.
Mm, I'm sure it has, yeah. Bored in the ring, wasn't it? Like,
so, yeah, there we go. That was the brief career of Stephen Norrington.
Ooh,
a man who. Fuck knows.
The highs and lows.
No, the high.
Of Stephen and the lows.
Yeah,
the
his high career and lows. Did seem to go up and up until 1998.
Mm. Yeah.
And then, but even then, he must have earned a pretty good fucking wage out of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Mm.
And he was even offered work afterwards. So it's not like he was blacklisted. He was still very much like, hey, Stephen, do you want to do this? And he just went, no.
It does sound very much like he was the architect of his own demise. Like, it, I mean, without being there, you can only speculate and stuff, but like the stories and his creative choices and everything else, you do have to sort of sit there and think, yeah, you did might have done this to yourself, mate.
It sounds like he did, yeah.
But also, I don't think Connery helped, being as you know, Connery being an old school actor in a modern film.
Yeah.
Not understanding things, and Connery, by all accounts, a bit of a formidable bloke.
Yeah.
I don't fucking get it.
Yeah, Connery was very much a man's man,
yeah.
If ever there was one. So, yeah, I can imagine. And if you're a
fairly new director.
Director, that's got to be intimidating.
With a big budget and a big production to take care of, plus Sean Connery giving you shit every day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not something I...
Maybe now that Connery's dead, he's going to come running out of his house. I'm free to work! Someone go! I've got all these ideas!
I still reckon there's a post-mortem clause in his will where he's paid people to keep an eye on Stephen Norrington, so if he ever does look at a script and green-light it, just from a back window somewhere.
From miles away.
Yeah. Just with
it's Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, just written on the bullet. What did I say? No, Stephen.
So, that was the career of Stephen Norrington.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. Right, movies to drink to. Go on Instagram and Facebook and all that shit and like us and follow share us and share us.
Tell us. Tell tales of our derring do.
Write reviews as long as the Iliad.
But
hit the 5-star button and just generally love us.
Tell your nan about us.
My nan would have a fucking
Or night. Just tell someone who's going to live longer. That would be even better.
That would be great. Have a kid, tell them.
But at the birth.
Yes.
By the way, listen to this podcast.
Watch this, drink this, listen to this.
So, hope you enjoyed that. Hope you learned something.
As much as we did.
I did, yeah. I learned some stuff.
It doesn't matter how high you get in your profession or when your dreams come true, you still might fuck it up.
Indeed. Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you all for coming here tonight and drinking all of my booze.